This interview discusses crime scenes. There is also brief mention of suicide. Listener discretion is advised. This is The Fall Line. We're back with more of our fascinating interview with Tracy Trace Sargent, one of the nation's leading canine search and rescue specialists. Last time, Trace walked us through her entrance into the world of search and rescue, how she trained her first dog, and some of the basics of cadaver dog training, and how dogs alert in different situations. This episode, we pick up on a subject that brought us together in the first place: water searches. It was the disappearance of Brian Worley, who was last seen at his parents' lakefront home in Carrollton, Georgia, in 2009, that introduced us to Trace and her team of working dogs. She worked the scene and eventually took her dogs out onto Lake Carroll to further search for Brian. In the next clip, we talk more about the ins and outs of water searches and how they differ from land searches. In our episode covering the disappearance of Brian Worley, you told us about how water searches are conducted. Can you talk to us about any other cases that have involved water and how that affected how the dogs interacted with scent?
We have worked a number of water cases over the years, and there's three that really stick out for me. One of them involved a lake, one of them involved a river, a large river, rushing river, and the other one was actually a small creek. Water itself, and the way to best describe how dogs work these different environments is that when we're working on land, where a dog alerts, X marks the spot. So if it sits down where it sits, barring any significant terrain features such as going downhill or uphill or something like that, generally where the dog sits, that's where we need to investigate on land. Whereas on water, it's much different. The dogs are still picking up scent. And one of the questions I get often, well, can dogs find dead people in water? And the answer is yes. How do they do that? Go back to what do dogs find? Dogs do not find bombs, bodies, or drugs. They find scent. Well, when you look at water, the deeper you go, the colder it is. Whereas the surface, and you get to the surface of the water, it gets warmer and then it gets almost hot at the surface itself. Scent itself is pulled up from cold water to warm water. So the scent is coming up out of the water and the dogs pick that up. And that's how they're able to find bodies underwater. Now, the challenge is in a water environment, where they alert is not essentially X marks the spot. It's more about an area. So I refer back to the lake. This happened in North Georgia. It was a fisherman. They saw his boat and even his ball cap on the lake just floating, but he was nowhere to be found. They assumed maybe he got off the boat to go, you know, get something to drink or go use the restroom or something. So they did do a land search. They didn't find him. So they called us in, and it's about a 120-acre lake, and nobody really knew where he was or even if he was in the lake. So you have this vast area. You can't have divers check that entire lake. So as we're searching the lake, we get to this little cove area, and the dog starts responding. We keep searching it, and we search it in different angles and different places within this cove, and they kept responding to this particular cove. So that's when we towed the divers out of this 120-acre lake. It's this half-acre cove area or smaller that the dogs are responding to. So that's where they focused their search efforts, and they actually found him about 30 minutes later. So that's the huge difference between working on land, X marks the spot. Working on water, it's really where the area that the dogs respond to, and that's where the search efforts should be done. Let me also expand on water operations themselves and why it makes it so challenging. of course, just the danger itself. There's all kinds of dangers that we can't see, the divers. It's just a very, very challenging thing. For the dogs themselves, we look at scent. So I mentioned three different cases. The lake itself, we found him. It was pretty calm conditions. It was a concealed lake. It didn't have like rivers coming in and out of it, things like that. Whereas a case we worked down in Macon a couple of years ago, it was a raging river. Very, very challenging conditions in every way. And one of those was just trying to figure out where the heck are we going to even search for this young man. His friends saw him swimming across and then he went underneath the water. So we at least started there. However, we don't start downstream from where he is. So try to imagine this. He's at this point in this river. If we search downstream, his scent is going downstream, and the dogs might alert several hundred yards away because his scent is being carried quite some distance downstream. Whereas when we look at this from a dog handler's perspective, our number one job as a dog handler for these working dogs is to get the dogs in an area where they're going to pick up scent for us and to increase that probability and make it as high as possible. So for that particular case, I did not put the dog downstream. You put them upstream and then you work downstream, and where they first start indicating to some type of scent or a change of behavior, the first time the dog responds in that river, that's where we're going to be closest to the body. Now, the challenge for that particular one that we had to overcome, the dog responded, but what happened is that he got tangled up in some, and we found this out later on, he got tangled up in some trees and all that, and the divers couldn't find him. So we actually came back and searched for him about 10 days later. Well, same thing. We started upstream. Well, the dog didn't alert where he alerted last time. He alerted about 100 yards downstream. Where he responded, I started looking at it, and I just recognized, oh my goodness, this is where, because terrain features that you can't see underwater, which makes it, again, challenging, the way the scent conditions were, the scent was actually coming up out of the water where the water was more shallow. So when I looked at that, and that's where the dog was responding, literally on a bank, he literally jumped out of the boat and went to the bank and started alerting right there at the bank. But I noticed that was where the water was more shallow. But then I looked upstream and I said, guys, because he's alerting downstream, I believe the young man is upstream from us. So let's continue working upstream. And the dog started going nuts. And that's where we found him. The water had receded enough. He was still hung up in that tree. And the dog was right on target. So water searches are very, very challenging in every way. And they can be very dangerous, especially for the divers. So it's something that does take special training for the dogs. Just because dogs can search for somebody on land doesn't mean that they can do it on water. So that is a special skill that dogs have to be trained for. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, it totally makes sense.
Yeah.
It's very logical when you think about it, especially with the idea of the water being shallow. And then, of course, he would be downstream from that. This is why I like doing these expert interviews so much. We never have access to this stuff, you know, as civilians. And then when the experts break it down in a simple way, it helps everyone understand better, like, how the process works.
I just thought about something when we talk about that particular case, and our job is to put the dogs in the high probable areas that they're going to find what we're looking for. You know what? It's the same thing when we do on land or even on disasters. So, for example, when I arrive on scene or even get a phone call, one of the things that's important to me as a dog handler and to increase the probability that we're going to have successful outcome and again, find what the officials asked us to find is that the question is, why is that person missing? For example, is it a runaway, Alzheimer's, suicide? Is it a kidnapping? Is it a murder case? Because not only do we have to look at terrain features, but we have to look at behaviors, human behavior. And I have to say, what's been really interesting over the years when I started doing searches outside of Alabama and Georgia, and let's say California or Oklahoma and different places I've been, honestly, human behavior's pretty much the same. So if we have, let's say, a homicide case that we're working and this man kidnapped this woman and killed her, his behavior is almost really identical to, let's say, somebody in another part of the country. So that's important for me, not only as a law enforcement officer and investigator, but more importantly as a canine handler, because there are very specific things that children do, Alzheimer's do, even suicidal individuals do. There's, of course, those exceptions and kind of outside the box of, you know, certain people that kind of, you know, do something a little bit differently. But for us, when we're searching an area, we don't do it haphazardly. We put the dog in what we call high probable areas first. So primary areas, ground zero, so to speak. Then we look at secondary areas. If we don't find anything there, then we expand in what we call ROW, the rest of the world. But again, not haphazardly. There's a reason why, you know, tips or leads, or maybe that person was familiar with that area, or somebody heard he had been hunting in that area, or he grew up in that area, or he had, you know, family property in this area, or whatever it might be. So there's a rhyme and reason to doing this. But for me, I've learned over the years, for lack of better of way explaining this, almost being in the shoes of the individual that we're looking for, or the shoes of the suspect. What would he do? Or suicide, what would she do? Or why would she come here? What interested her in this area? So it's so much more than just working a dog. It is a mystery. And it's so many parts to this that I love. And that's one of those, is to figure out what people do and why they do it, so we can find these individuals as quickly as possible and hopefully bring them home alive. But if we can't, you know, find their loved ones and bring them home, even if they're deceased.
One of the most singular experiences Trace has had so far has involved helping an archaeologist in the excavation of a Revolutionary War-era battle site here in Georgia, Kettle Creek. In the next clip, she tells us about training her dogs to take on a 250-year-old case. And just a note here, you'll hear Trace mention 350 years in the interview. As she laughingly told me when we were reviewing the tape, she was doing math in her head, so treat that as a figure of speech. On the subject of unraveling mysteries, we were looking at a New York Times article that was published last year, and it discussed that there's some thought that cadaver dogs might be helpful to archaeologists by alerting to scents of ancient remains. Given your own experience, does that seem possible? I know you've talked to me about working a really old case, for instance.
Well, Laura, that just kind of brought back memories of years ago when I got a phone call from an archaeologist, and he had just went to a presentation and heard about cadaver dogs. He had never heard of cadaver dogs. He didn't know what they did, and he certainly never thought about putting the cadaver dog world into his world. Well, when he reached out to me, he said, "Tracy, I'm working on this project and I've heard that cadaver dogs can help us with certain things. And I was just wondering if you would be interested in, you know, something that, you know, you would help us with." So as we went into the details of the project, I kind of paused because when he said what he was doing, I thought, oh my goodness. If my math is correct, that's like 350 years old. And he said, yes. And I said, sir, I got to be honest with you. I really don't train my dogs for 350-year-old remains. Why would I? And I said, but I tell you what, if you don't tell the dogs, I won't either. Because my thought was, One, they're searching for scent, whether it's dead, you know, for a long time or for a short time, they're just looking for scent. But two, we both felt like we really didn't have anything to lose. It's not going to hurt the project. It's not going to, you know, make it any less if we don't find anything. But you know what? I'm willing to give it a try if you are. And that's how it all started. So in preparing the dogs for it, I was trying to, you know, look at this from a broad stroke of, all right, again, how do we increase the chances that the dogs are going to find what we're looking for? In essence, we want to set them up for success and not failure. So the first thing I recommended to him is that not do it in the summertime or springtime. Fall, you know, we can a little bit, but really the best time, at least this part of the country, which we're talking about Georgia, would be wintertime, because we don't have really harsh winters here, but the scent conditions would be better for the dogs, but also it's going to be cooler for the dogs and they can work, a lot longer and, you know, a lot larger areas as well. So that was the first parameter that we put in. And then secondly, I thought, oh my goodness, all right, probably not going to be a lot of scent. Now, one of the things that helped us in this was based upon this battlefield, they did find research that in most cases, not all, that they would have mass graves. So I thought, well, that at least helps if we have multiple bodies in one location. That's going to at least help the scent be a little bit stronger than, let's say, just one body in hundreds of acres. So, okay, that helps. We've got the time of year, that helps. Okay, now how do we help the dog find scent that's pretty minute? So that's when I focused on the threshold of the dogs. So before we went out there, all I did was work the dogs on very low threshold. And one of those was just, I would put like 3 teeth out there. And these are teeth that I've had for many, many years. And the dogs would find it. Then I would get them down to 2 teeth. And then I would get them down to 1 tooth. So that is literally training them to find very minute scent. Well, we did everything we could to prepare for that. And we went out there. He just basically said, here's the area, go for it. So I had 2 dogs, Chance and Cinco. Cinco passed away several years ago of old age. Chance is actually 11 now, and he's still working, but he'll be retiring later this year. So those 2 dogs searched these areas and they started showing a pattern in this particular area. So I put flags and I marked and explained to him what the dogs did and da da da. Well, one of the things that I learned too and have since learned in historical, what we call historical cases, this is what's unique and different about land searches for historical versus other cases. Let's say somebody that's been missing for a year. Because of time, and we look at trees and the root systems and just the topography changes over the years and rainwater and all of that, we've learned that in historical cases like this one, where the dog's alerted, it's not X marks the spot. My recommendation was approximately 30 feet radius because of the root systems. We actually had both dogs alert to a specific tree, literally wanting to climb the tree. So we looked at the root system that based upon the age of this tree, it's about 30 feet away. Because cadaver fluids themselves, it's fluid and it's going to be absorbed by scent. And we've actually seen my dogs in the past alert to bushes. And sure enough, that's where the grave was underneath the bush. The dogs weren't alerting to the ground. It's the scent was literally coming out of the bush. It's fascinating to see it. So that particular historical project, we advised to search in like a 30 to 50 foot radius of where the dogs alerted. Well, when I showed him the flags and I showed him the different places, that was when he explained to me, well, when the battle occurred between the Americans and the British soldiers, this is a Revolutionary War battlefield project. They uh, They literally did a surprise attack of the Americans, and they ran them down and basically slaughtered them. And he said, Tracy, were your dogs alerted? That is the same area that we have found in our research of where this occurred. So he didn't tell us that beforehand. We went in it blind, but the dogs were consistent with what his research was. So it was just a really fun, interesting, really adventure for all of us because it was new to all of us. And since that time, we've worked a number of other historical projects. And I have to tell you one right quick, Kettle Creek here in Georgia. It's really going to become a very famous project that they've been working on. There's a lot of information online about it, but just to tell you about the dog part of it, when we searched that area, we again had the dogs alert in specific areas. We marked them. Well, we were working with some other teams on this, and we learned from the other project that, okay, we've got this unique situation. Let's approach it from a scientific point of view. Not only, you know, from archaeology or, you know, the archaeologist point of view, but also a scientific point of view. What are these dogs really alerting on and why here and this and that? So we actually kind of going through just kind of working our way and feeling our way through this. The writing report, that which will be released here any day now, I will just tell you a little bit about it. Where the dogs alerted, they had one of the scientists come out here. He actually brought some soil from one of those graves, and then we put some blank other dirt out there. And the dogs had alerted, and I was working blind on this, the dogs had alerted on this particular soil. My point is, what I didn't know is that where the dogs alerted, they alerted, I think it was 8 out of 8 samples. So then he took those samples and sent it to a lab that specializes in old human DNA, I think up to 10,000 years. So they actually analyzed that soil. Now, admittedly, he told me, he said, Tracy, the first soil sample that I did, you know, I really didn't know exactly what the protocols were, so it really didn't pick up anything. So they didn't even count that one. But these other 7 samples that the dogs alerted to, guess what they found at the lab?
What?
They found human DNA in all 7 samples. And when he called me and he said, I've got the lab results. Honestly, Laura, I thought, you know what? If we get even 20% right, I'll be happy, you know, because it's just so overwhelming odds that this would even work at all. But he said, Tracy, it was 100% correct. Your dogs were 100%. We found human DNA in every soil sample that we sent them, and it's where the dogs alerted to. And that was at Kettle Creek. That was really cool. So it's, I just never know where this journey is going to take me. And that's one example of it.
So I guess the answer to, do you think it's possible, is yes.
Yes. And I would say that although it was fascinating to see all this, you know, unfold in front of us, but the essence of why I do this didn't change. And that is finding these loved ones. There are descendants of these soldiers that are involved in this, and they have, you know, they're greatly invested in it, obviously for personal reasons, but also recognizing these men and the sacrifices they made. So for me, it as fascinating as it was, and as interesting as it was, and just disbelief that this really worked, and just being a part of that, it's just a real privilege and honor. It truly is.
You just mentioned your dog Chance and the fact that his retirement is coming up. And you've actually discussed your dogs and their retirement in a few different articles and said that if a dog works for you, that dog retires with you. What does that mean and why is that important?
You know, Laura, the sad part about doing this kind of work for me, especially as long as I have, I've outlived all of my partners so far. And that's tough. Oh my goodness. It's just, these aren't just dogs to me. They're so much more. They're teammates, they're companions, they're therapists, they're you know, just their family members. They're so much more than just a dog to me. And when they do retire, it is tough, just like Chance. I see him aging. I see him slowing down. And, you know, I want so badly for him to go on these adventures with me. And I wish he would live forever. All the dogs I've worked with have just been amazing partners for me over the years. So when they do retire, it is a tough adjustment for them. But they stay with me for life because they deserve that. And I'm committed to them for the rest of their lives. Cinco died a few years ago of old age, right here with his pack in the backyard. I was there with him, and Chance and Draco were with him. He was in his home with his pack. He passed away peacefully. And for Chance, that's what I hope for him as well. So when I get these dogs, and for example, Draco, he's 7, and Taz is 1.5 years. Well, these aren't just machines to me or tools to me. They're family members. So whether they were a personal family dog, companion dog, or a working dog, when I take a dog in, I'm committed to them for life, and they deserve that. And there's a great bond, and I could not imagine them, you know, going anywhere else, even when they're retired. They should stay here with me.
What's one thing that you wish people knew about your work or that is commonly misunderstood?
I would say the thing that comes to mind the most is this isn't glamorous. It's not Hollywood. It's not for the lighthearted. It's not about fame or fortune. It's so much about so many things it's not, that people may have that perception it is. For example, it's fascinating. That line of work and all that. Yes, it is interesting in itself, but people don't see the dedication, the sacrifices. I do this as a volunteer, but it's very expensive. The heartbreak that you see with these families, the tragedies, and quite frankly, the good and evil. I've seen incredible human spirit overcome overwhelming tragedy, and that's inspiring, but it's also very, very sad. And for me, it gives me more motivation to do this, not less. So people need to really understand first and foremost why they do this. And I think probably the best way to describe it is this. When I'm teaching a class or doing a seminar, I do ask the students, when my phone rings, just as it has a couple of times in this interview, and I know it's a search, what's the first thing that comes to my mind? And I ask the students that, and someone will respond, well, which dog to take, or the equipment, or, you know, different things like that. And I said, no, guys, that's not it. And this is what I want to get across to you. And this is what I want to get across to listeners and to anybody that's interested in pursuing this. It's not about any of that. It's about this. It's about the fact that somebody's life and a family's life has changed forever. I can't undo that. But I'm going to do everything in my power and my dog's abilities to help them through this, whether the outcome is good and we bring their loved one back home alive and well, or if their loved one unfortunately is deceased for whatever reason, to bring them back home too. It's about people's lives. It's real people, real families, and real tragedies. And that's what this is all about. And if somebody chooses this type of passion, because it should be a passion, not an endeavor, not something to do just with your dog, it should be a passion. And that means making those sacrifices and that dedication to doing everything you can physically and mentally for yourself and for your dog, to do everything for that family. Because for me, when I get these phone calls, it's not about, again, the glory or the Hollywood or sensationalism or anything like that. I do take it very, very personally that these are fragile families, that they have invited me into their lives during the darkest days of their lives. I'm very protective of them, and I'm going to do everything in my power to help them through this, to find the answers that they deserve to all the questions that they have, and help the officials seek justice if that's the type of case we're working. Whatever it takes to help that family through this, I'm committed to doing it. And guys, that's what it's all about, not about all that other stuff. And I tell my students, if I ever lose sight of that, I'll get rid of the truck, the equipment, everything, and never do it again. And that's what I stay committed to.
I think this is probably the perfect time to tell our listeners that you've started your own podcast that touches on a lot of the themes that you were just discussing, and it's called The Seeker's Quest. You told me a story about why you decided to begin your podcast, and I hope you would kind of share some of those feelings and why you started it with our listeners.
Over the years, I have worked a number of cases, and I don't really talk about it. I don't, you know, brag about it. I don't post it and all of that. I'm actually very private, especially about the cases that I work. But people have heard about me and my dogs involved in this case or that case and so on and so forth. And I've had people tell me, hey, you really need to write a book. You really need to tell people your stories and the cases you've worked. And I've always kept it at arm's length because I just didn't feel right about it, Laura. That's not why I do it. It never has been and it never will be. And it just was just something I did not feel comfortable doing. So what changed that was this. I don't really do social media, but I do try to support friends that have a good cause. And this particular call, she wanted people, specifically canine handlers that have working dogs, to post pictures for 10 days. It's like that 10-day challenge kind of thing. And I thought, well, you know, it's for a good cause. It's for, you know, law enforcement and military and other people that are involved in this world. And I thought, okay. So I posted one picture of my dog and she asked not to describe anything. So I didn't. Well, my goodness, several people got on and said, hey, I know this is probably a search you're doing. Can you tell us a little bit about it? So I just, you know, not mentioning any names or locations, I said, oh, yeah, this is da-da-da. Well, then I posted the next picture the next week and or next day and all of that. And that just kind of ballooned into these 10 days as I was posting pictures. People wanted to know what that picture was about because they knew it was about missing persons. Then I got some calls from some family members and some other canine handlers, again, about writing a book and all of that. It's like, no, 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 no. Well, what happened in all of that, and just by accident, there were some other cases that came up in some other situations that really sensationalized some things. And it was a case I worked, and I just didn't feel comfortable with it because there are some wonderful, wonderful programs out there that really highlight the essence of these cases. But what I felt was the family, specifically, their voices get lost in all of this sometimes. And the true essence of what me and the dogs do, but also more importantly, what the families go through. I really struggled. I really, really struggled. And I just didn't feel right about it. But a part of me was like, well, maybe this is something I should do and I should look into because it would at least give these families a voice and an outlet to tell their story, not just about, you know, the facts of the case, so to speak, but more importantly, how it affected them as an individual and as a family themselves, because it does change their lives forever. So I just started a few pages in a book and I just stopped it. I was like, no, I can't do it. I have spoken on several podcasts such as yours, and it just inspired me to go in that direction. I'm like, this feels a lot better. Instead of putting even family members' words on paper, they can say their own words and their own voice. And that's what inspired me. And that's what inspired me to start this podcast called The Seeker's Quest. And it's specifically named for that because that's exactly not only what I do, I'm a seeker on a quest seeking something. But it's also tied into these families and even officials. They too themselves are seekers on a quest to find something, to find answers. So it was the perfect name for this new endeavor. And it's been a new endeavor, honestly, that I never thought I would do or get involved with. And it's been overwhelming positive response. It talks about the beginning of it, the introduction, gives you backgrounds on how I was inspired to do this and what led to this. It really did start 10,000 miles away from home because I had just worked a case here in Georgia, and then I had to get on a plane and go overseas for a job I was doing over there. And I get a email from the cold case unit folks to tell me, oh, Tracy, by the way, your dogs were 100% right. We did find him. Were your dogs alerted? And that just, as I'm sitting there in this foreign country in the Middle East, it just struck me as I looked around and I thought, wow, I was doing special ops work and I was a supervisor over there and doing some really interesting things. And I just said to myself, I don't know exactly how I got here. And I think back about those first days working with Joe and the other law enforcement guys. And I thought, oh my heavens, I never dreamed in a million years that I would ever, ever accomplish the things that I've done and been a part of some of the things that I've been a part of. And I'm just sitting, looking around, thinking, how in the world did I get here? I don't know exactly how I did, but I'm glad I'm here. And it's been an amazing, privileged journey and quest with these families and officials that I hope to do with the rest of my life.
And as of today, which is August 20th, I know this will come out a bit later, you've released 3 episodes, right?
Yes.
And you plan on just keeping going, releasing episodes as you have time. And most of these are going to be multi-part stories?
Yes, that's correct.
And I know you're going to delve into a couple cases that our listeners will probably be familiar with, right? Like Chase Messner?
Yes, that is correct. A unique position I have been in is that when you think about law enforcement officers, you know, focus on the bad guys, drugs, crime, things like that. And then search and rescue and recovery look at, you know, from a civilian point of view of looking for a lost child or even, you know, human remains. Well, I've lived in both of those worlds. And it's a unique position to be in because I have looked for all kinds of people. This podcast isn't just about human remains or finding a child. It involves and dives into all kinds of cases I've worked over the years and really the full spectrum of all types of environments and situations that I've worked. The first one is actually about a fugitive, a very dangerous fugitive that I tracked down in Georgia. And the second one is about a missing hunter. The third one will be about a little boy, a 3-year-old boy. The fourth one, it's either going to be Chase Messner, which is the war veteran that we found. He had been missing for 3.5 years. Also, we have a woman that disappeared for four days, and we found her alive by some miracle. And then also a homicide case called The Husband's Killers. That involves a very unique situation, and we found the husband that unfortunately was deceased in this very interesting and strange case. So the first season is really very different from bad guys to children, old people, Alzheimer's, to homicide. It's just a variety of cases, I've just really very privileged to be a part of both of those worlds. And I've searched criminals, fugitives, very dangerous ones over the years, done disasters. There's a case that I'm going to work in season two that was actually highlighted in the chapter of an award-winning book about a case we did in Tuscaloosa when the tornado came through years ago. I think it's actually appropriate to say the chapter of the book is actually called Chance, and it's because of my dog Chance and what he did in that particular situation, that disaster. It was a tornado disaster. So, and I've worked plane crashes, military plane crashes. I've even worked serial killer cases, the Todd Colekeep case in South Carolina. So just whatever type of situation you can think about, somebody missing, whatever it might be, I've worked short of an avalanche. I haven't done those because we don't have, fortunately, that much snow here in Georgia. But other than that, I've pretty much worked them all, and I'm happy to work them all. So it's I don't really think about how much I've done until I, you know, people start asking me questions like, oh my goodness, I had forgotten about that one, or I think about this one. So it's been, an incredible ride. And I'm so excited to share this with the world. And right now, we just released the first part of A Sleeping Hunter is what it's called. The episodes are released the 1st and 15th of each month. We will release part two of A Hunter, and it's going to be four parts. And I will tell you just a little bit of tidbits about this particular case. The first one is us searching for him, and then the second part is us finding him. The third part is actually his wife. The entire episode is the wife talking and explaining what her family went through, not only when he disappeared, but when they found him. And I just cannot wait to share that with the world. It just gives you chills when you hear it from the family's perspective. And then the fourth part, it too gave me chills because it's a raw interview between the wife and myself. I didn't edit it in any way. And what it really turned out to be, and it's really explaining the Seeker's Quest, you will see unfolding how these two women had individual goals, but the same quest, and how that happened in the end. It's just, I can't wait to share it with everyone.
Trace's podcast will eventually touch on her work in all the cases she's mentioned. If you're not familiar with Chase Masner, he was a veteran of the Iraq War who disappeared in 2014. After an argument with his wife, he spent the night at a friend's house and never came home to his family. In 2020, investigators recovered his remains buried in that same friend's backyard. Todd Culhepp is a South Carolina serial killer who murdered at least seven people, including the staff of Superbike Motorsports in Chesney. Trace's work has taken her all over the country and the world, and her commitment to the families of the missing, whether they be the victims of crimes or natural disasters, is really inspiring. She knows everything there is to know about canine search and rescue, and we've learned so much from her. We hope you'll check out her new podcast, The Seeker's Quest. Thank you for listening. The Fall Line is a fully independent show, and we appreciate listener support. It allows us to do research, obtain FOIA, pay our content advisors, and support and donate to the causes we care about. If you try out the products we advertise, please use our sponsor codes. It really helps. And if you'd like to support the show and the stories we cover, join us on Patreon. We're raising Patreon funds to continue to fund the Millbrook Twins billboard, begin a therapy fund for families who've been on the show, and many other projects. You can read a public post about those goals on Patreon. Each and every one of our patrons helps us continue this work, and we're so grateful for your help. On Patreon, you'll get early release, ad-free versions of our regular episodes, plus blogs and videos for only $5 a month. We've also added live streams, which all patrons can enjoy, starting at just $1.
The Fall Line is written, hosted, and researched by Laura Norton, with additional research by Brian Waters and Kim Fritz. Family interviews by Brooke Hargrove. Produced, engineered, and scored by Maura Curry. Content advisement by Brandy C. Williams, Liv Fallon, and Vic Kennedy. And, as always, our most special thanks to Angie Dodd. Currently, our monthly donation is going to Private Investigations for the Missing. Please, join us in supporting this nonprofit. They need funds to help families access the services of PIs.